Morning, if you would, open your Bibles with me to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. John 1. We're really happy to be here with you guys. It's been fun even to have a bunch of 8-second conversations, the TikTok conversations with everybody this morning so far. But more importantly, besides seeing your faces and getting to greet you and looking forward to the next few days and more of that, I'm really happy that we've been able to share in these songs to encourage each other to love the Lord more and think better about Him. I'm thankful that we've been able to share the supper together and have this moment of peace and unity together in the Spirit of our God. So thank you all for having us here with you. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through Him. And apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness did not grasp it. There came a man sent from God whose name was John. And he came as a witness to testify about the light so that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came to testify about the light. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. The world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But to those who did receive him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh, and he dwelt or tabernacled among us, and we saw his glory. Glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified about him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me.' For of his fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came into existence, were realized through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has revealed him." This is an amazing text about the person that we all came to think about today. The person that those of us who sang these songs and prayed these prayers, the person who we believe in as the thing, not even the greatest thing or the best thing, but the thing that makes everything else make sense. Now, maybe you're here today and that may not be true for you. Maybe that somebody brought you here, maybe a friend, maybe you've just been looking for something and you're wondering if maybe this story would make any sense or make a difference for you. So I'm glad you're here and I hope these things will be a consideration for you. But I want to say, even if you already believe deeply in Jesus, if you're here every time, even if you're going to be here every time, even the two extra nights this week, you really are into this stuff. It's important that we reflect upon passages like this. To think about, what do I really think about Jesus? Verse 14 is a wonderful summation, verses 14 through 18 in particular. Jesus is described as the Word. We'll come back to that in a second. It talks about how he came near. So there must be something really important because he came all the way down from where he was and who he was to become flesh. And we know what that's like. With all the frailties and insecurities and challenges that brings, he became a part of that. So that he could unveil something to us. So that actually he could bring into existence something that otherwise we'd be lost without. And the text says in verse 14, whenever we look at Jesus, and maybe I should pause for a second, and when you, in your mind's eye, when you look at Jesus, what is it that you see? Probably a lot of different things, depending on who you are and how you've been taught and how you've been introduced. Maybe what you see is a very nice man who helps people who are in trouble. That's right. Jesus was more than nice. He was kind. He was gracious. He was a lover of people. And he did what he could to help those. Maybe you see someone who's brave, who speaks truth to power, who stands up for what's right, who always obeys God, no matter what the consequence might be. And that's true, too. Jesus is a heroic figure. In all the heroes of human history, he's a heroic figure who's courageous. Or maybe you see someone who's wise and thoughtful and a good guide for your life. And that's certainly true. But the way that John, who knew Jesus intimately, matter of fact, when you read through the Gospel of John, the presentation is that he knew him most intimately, perhaps even among some of the closest disciples. He understood Jesus. And what he said that he saw, or he said we saw, those who beheld him first, we saw his glory. We saw his glory. He repeats that again a little later in the text. And of course, right here in this verse, glory as of the only begotten of the Father. I think you guys are thinking about the word glory a lot these days here. But maybe it'd be good just to, again, refresh our minds on what this word even means. The idea of glory sometimes is associated with something that's shiny or bright. Matter of fact, there's one moment where Jesus, the text says that he was glorified among his kind of inner circle of disciples, the three on the mountain. And yet the description that Matthew gives of Jesus' glorification is that his face shone as bright as the sun. And that's part of what glory carries with it. There's a shininess with glory. But you know, there's probably more to it than just being shiny. So what else is it? Well, sometimes the idea of glory is associated with someone giving you glory, right? Like you do something and people say, wow, that was amazing. That was awesome. Matter of fact, this isn't just a religious, churchy word. We know this. Some of you who are involved in sports, maybe you're a coach, maybe you're a player, or you used to be, and you still think you have glory, so you revel in your glory days. You know, people will say, well, let's say things just like that. Back in the glory days, the idea is back when people approved of me, and I didn't look like a loser whenever I tried to get out and run around with the kids and stuff. Or people will say things to motivate, and they say, no guts, no glory. The idea is you got to put in a lot of work. You got to put in a lot of effort if you want to be approved, if you want to accomplish something that actually means something. So maybe the idea of approval or something like that goes along with glory. If I understand it correctly, the word that's translated glory in the Old Testament carries with it the idea of heaviness or something that weighs a lot. Which Paul seems to key in on this in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where he talks about how in Christ we have a weight of glory. All right, so shininess, being approved or having some sort of accomplishment you get recognized for, heaviness, what is all this stuff? What is it saying about Jesus? I'm not sure if this would help you, but the way that I've kind of been tying these ideas together when I think about glory lately is that for someone or something to be glorious, it means that it's something of real, true significance. If something's heavy, that means there's a lot of it. It's a significant portion, right? Your plate's heavy. You got a lot on there. Whenever something shines, it blots out everything else. Whenever the sun shines, we can't see anything else. It's the only thing that we see. The significance of the sun's rays diminish everything else. And there's lots of stuff out there, but we can't even see it. And of course, whenever you're commended at work or you receive some sort of approval from someone who loves you or whatever, the thing that's being communicated to you is that you mean something. You matter. You're significant. John is saying here, Jesus is the significant one. Matter of fact, he's the only one that has significance. He's so significant. Well, he uses a variety of images, and we'll come to that in a second. Here's how we're going to think about this as we think about the glory of Jesus. First, I want to think about what is the thing that makes Jesus so significant. To an extent that John would talk about him in ways that really only apply to Jesus. That he's the only significant one. He's the only thing that matters in the universe. So what is it that makes Jesus significant? How should we think about that? And then secondly, what are we supposed to do about it? What's the proper response to the glory of Jesus that he's revealed? All right, so first, let's think about this glory a little bit. You notice in the text, John does a little bit at the beginning of using images to help us understand Jesus' significance. And then he uses some concrete characteristics of Jesus to help us see his significance. At the beginning of the text, he describes him, and actually in verse 1 and again in verse 14, he describes Jesus as the Word. And perhaps what he's indicating is Jesus is the communication from God to human beings. And that's certainly true. You even see that near the end of the text where it says he has explained or revealed him. That word that is translated in verse 18, explained or revealed, it's used in other contexts to talk about people telling a story. Like in Luke 24, after the people had met Jesus, they came back and they explained or revealed, they retold the tale of what they had experienced with Jesus. So maybe that's the idea of Jesus is the Word. He's this communication of God's true nature. And certainly that makes him quite significant. But maybe there's something even more going on with the word that John's using here. This word that's translated in English, word, is the Greek word logos, which carries with it, for the Greeks at least of the time, more than just here's a word of communication. But the Greeks, they understood the world is orderly and things are put together and things are predictable and we live here and it all works and there's got to be something that makes that happen, right? Now, there would be debates about what that is. Of course, it was kind of tough, I would imagine. I don't know. I didn't live back then. But I would imagine it was tough to assign that to any of their gods because their gods were sort of petulant and unpredictable and not very gracious. And so it must have been tough for them to come up with, I don't know if Zeus is the one that put all this thing together. I mean, he's powerful, but I don't know if he's the one. So whatever it was and however it came about, the Greeks came with this notion of there's something that undergirds the entirety of the universe. It's the reason for everything, the logos. In other words, what is that? How did it come about? Who knows? What John is doing here is saying, hey, you guys want to know about the thing that makes the universe work? You want to know about the thing that is the basis for all things? Let me tell you about him. Jesus Christ, the logos. But he doesn't stop there. There's another image he uses. Besides this fundamental reality that undergirds all things in the universe, he describes him as the life, or the creator of all life. Do you notice the emphasis he gives on that? Which goes right along with this idea of being the fundamental reality of all things. It says, all things came into being through him. Got it. All things came through him. Are you sure you got it? Because apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. I mean, he says the same thing twice. And his point is to make it very clear to you that you have no life. There's no plants. There's no water. There's no human beings. There's no breath in your lungs. There's nothing. There's no stars, sun, nothing apart from this individual that I'm trying to tell you about. Now think about all the significance that we assign to nature and to the stars and to the universe and all these things. And he's saying, yeah. Whatever you think is so great about that stuff, you realize that I'm telling you about somebody who put all that together, that he made all that happen, that he's actually making all that happen. As you sit here and breathe and think and do all the stuff that you're subconsciously doing, you're not even doing it, you're just there. He's the reason for all of those things. In him was life. And then he uses another image. Not only is he the logos and the source of all life, but he's also the light. And of course, that has a lot of beautiful things. And those of you who are much more knowledgeable and wise in the scientific fields, you could give us great explanations of the meaning of the idea of Jesus being the light and how that gives, parameters for life on earth and gives us the sense of where to go and how to be and all that sort of stuff. But in a biblical sense and in a sort of existential sense, of course, many times the concept of light is not just used in scientific terms, but it's used in terms of, what it says right here. The light came into the world and enlightens every man, verse 9. He gives us light. We use this kind of language whenever we talk about people. People will talk about their child or someone romantically that they love or whomever it may be, and they say, that person is the light of my life. They mean, is this the thing that makes life worth living? This is what gives me joy and gives me a sense of being and purpose and all that sort of thing. John says, the one I'm telling you about, he's the one who does that. Now, I just want to pause for a second and ask you to do a little reflecting here. Would you talk about, if you were asked to give your own soliloquy about Jesus, is that the way you would talk about him? Is that the way you would talk about him? I'm not asking if you're as poetically gifted or inspired in John's case to be able to talk this way. But I mean, would you assign that much worth, value? Would you give him that much shine? Would you acknowledge him as being as significant as John does right here? The truth is, every one of us assign glory to something, or we see glory in something. You see glory in someone who you love, or at least you thought they were glorious till you start getting involved with them and you realize, on to the next one. Maybe it's a job or maybe it's some hobby or something that gives you a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure, a lot of peace. And you think, man, this is the thing. And really, you reorder your whole life around it. All your thoughts and all your dreams are centered on that thing. All of your investments, whether it be your time, your emotion, your money, you invested in that thing. Every relationship, every activity has to get formed around the thing that you see as truly glorious. Now, John's appeal to us, and really the appeal of the entirety of the gospel of Christ, is to recognize Jesus as the significant thing. So I'd like you to marinate on that as we keep going and try to reflect upon, do I think about him like this? Is he the light of my life? Or do I just think he's great? And I'm glad that he bails me out of problems, you know, like because of his wisdom, I don't mess up as much as my friends. And I'm really thankful that when I do make a mistake, he gets me off the hook with God and forgives me and all that kind of stuff. Look, if that's the way you think about Jesus, then you have an entirely too low view of who he is and what he means. You don't see his glory. Or someone might say, well, what is it that makes him all? All those are just sort of images that really just highlight this idea of his significance. Well, what is it that makes him really significant? What makes him more significant than family and friends, than whatever pleasures I might pursue in the world, whatever work accomplishments I might have, whatever other thing might be the centerpiece, the gravity of your life? What makes him so much greater? Verse 14, John explains it. It says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory. Glory as of the only begotten of God. He's not just an ordinary man, nor is he a distant God. He's the God-man who came near to us. And whenever he came near to us and showed us God's true nature, what he showed is that he was full of grace and truth. Full of grace and truth. The word grace is used in a variety of ways, actually, in the New Testament. One way is, it may have even been, I can't remember clearly, but the concept was certainly read at the end of Justin's talk at the table, where we're sinners, we're lost, we got nothing going for us, but because of God's love for us, he has extended favor to us. He's forgiven us of our sins. He's allowed us to have the hope of eternal life, all these great things. And in that way, he's shown us grace. Now, whenever we receive grace from God, it's something that's undeserved. And it's not really a characteristic that's intrinsic to who we are. In other words, whenever God shows us favor, it's not because it's favorable for God or that we on our own merits are favored before God. Jesus is a whole different ballgame. You remember the commentary given about Jesus when he was 12 years old? 12-year-old Jesus, Luke chapter 2. You remember that bit about the temple, right? He was in the temple doing his father's will. His mom said, you need to come home, though. So he goes home with his parents. And it says that he grew up, and he grew up in favor with God and with man. Now, and it's the same word, by the way. Grace, favor, it's the exact same word. Just translated differently because, honestly, I think it just sounds weird to translate that. And Jesus grew in grace with God and man. Because the way we think about grace is it's like a gift. And a lot of times it is. When God shows you favor, that is a gift. But actually, the word just means to be favored or favorable or something is a favor. Right? Jesus was full of favor with God. He did things that were right in the sight of God. He acted just the way God would act. Actually, the way God did act whenever Jesus himself came on earth. And he was also favorable toward other people. Maybe another way you could think about this is this is the beauty of Jesus. Whenever you look at him, behold him. Here's what I mean. There's a friend that we have in Brooklyn who's a Christian. He came out of an Eastern religion that had a very harsh and false view of God and who God is. And so he realized this is probably not real. He saw some of the injustices that religious system perpetuated. And so he came out of that and he was searching and he found Jesus. And he believes in Jesus. But like all of us, and I'll say maybe a little bit more for him because he hasn't grown up on pews. His family and friends are not only not Christians, they would be very opposed to his new faith. It's kind of challenging. He's working out a lot of stuff. And so we were talking a couple weeks ago. And I just asked him, I said, hey, I don't mean this to be offensive. And I know you're a Christian. But do you really, really believe in the gospel? And I mean that factually. Like, do you believe that Jesus actually died, that he actually rose from the dead? If you had to go 0 to 100... what would be your commitment to those historical truths? And I'll be honest, I was sometimes you ask those questions to give people confidence. They say, well, I'm 100% committed. You say, well, then you're going to be okay. And he was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. And I was like, oh man, wrong speech. Like, I don't know what to do now. And I thought, I said, wait. And I mean, he said, I believe that, but sometimes I kind of wonder, you know, I'm not really sure. I was like, dude, how did you ever become a Christian then? Because this is the thing, to believe in these historical realities. This is what the whole thing's based on. He's like, well, I mean, I've come to believe in those things, and I work on believing those things. But really, for me, the thing that drew me to becoming a Christian is I observed things about Jesus that I'd never seen in any person that I'd ever met, or certainly not in any stories of any religious leader. The way Jesus treated those who were lowly, the way he was courageous, the way he had integrity, the way he was honest all the time, the self-sacrifice, the love, all those things, those favorable things about Jesus is what drew me in. That was really, I think that's really true. And I think that happens a lot of times. Now, by the way, that's not the end of the story. We're going to get more to that in just a second. But here's my point. Part of the thing that makes Jesus really significant is recognizing those beautiful attributes of Jesus. And if you're sitting here and you were reflecting a minute ago and you're like, no, you know, honestly, I make a lot of decisions based on my bank account or on just what would make me feel good in the moment or what everybody around me thinks I should do. That's the glory that I seek after. That's the significant thing that I'm orienting my life around. Maybe I want to encourage you, not maybe, I want to encourage you that probably one of the big things you're missing is you don't see the grace, the favor of Jesus. The favor that he had with God, the favor that he has with God, the favor that he even had with people. As a matter of fact, there was an occasion where Jesus would speak and the people said, wow, what favor, what grace words are coming out of his lips. Whenever people would see Jesus behaving, they would see all these things. You need to go back and see that, because I'll tell you, there's nobody like Jesus of Nazareth, who those of us who are Christians acknowledge as Jesus the Christ, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There's really nobody like him in human history. He's totally unique. Besides the fact that he's the God-man. You can start right there. But even move past the God-man thing and look to the way he interacts with people and the way he seems, in a way, totally detached from the world. In terms of, he doesn't care about what you think about him. He doesn't care about trying to fit in with your standards or your models for what human behavior is supposed to be like or what is good or what is right. He's totally detached from those things. And yet, he's completely engaged with every person that he's with, seeking out their good, sacrificing whatever he has of himself. Jesus truly is full of grace. But as we said a minute ago with our friend, that's not really going to be enough, at least not according to John. Because, you know, there actually are a lot of brave people, a lot of kind people, a lot of people who have integrity and all the things that make that prove Jesus to be favorable before God and before people. The other thing that John says is that Jesus, his glory is composed not only of his grace, but also of his truth, of his truth. Now, perhaps what John is saying is that Jesus always tells the truth. And that's right. Or maybe ratchet it up a little bit and John's saying that Jesus tells us about the truths of God. The things that God says are right and good and the way things ought to be and the way things are and the way things are going to be. All that sort of deal. And Jesus reveals those. And that's certainly true. Jesus said so much himself. Do you remember? Where he said, if you live in my word, then you will truly be my disciples. And you will know the truth. And the truth will set you free. So there Jesus attaches the truth to the propositions that he lays out in his teachings. But I want to just break it down one more layer to think about what it means for Jesus to be full of truth. When you say something is true, or you're telling the truth, what that means is you're telling someone what's real. It's not fake stuff. And I want to use that word because truth can kind of become just an abstraction that may not be as helpful. But I want you to think about how what Jesus came to reveal, or what makes him glorious, is that Jesus is the real deal. A lot of us are looking for real things. Go back to all that stuff that you struggle with, that you allow to become the centerpiece of your life, the most significant thing. The realest thing about you is what your friends and family say and if they approve of you or not. Or the realest thing about you is how much money you have in the bank. Or the realest thing about you is how many accomplishments you have in your work life. Or the realest thing about you is, you fill in the blank, whatever it is. Jesus came to unveil real reality. Not all the stuff that Satan has convinced us is real or good or true or whatever, but he came to unveil what's actually happening and what actually exists and what actually will happen in the future. He's full of grace and he's full of truth. That's why he would oftentimes call people out and say, "Why don't you listen to me?" He would tell stories and he would begin them. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. And the point was, if you don't, you're going to miss the whole deal. You're going to be living in a fantasy land. And if you live in a fantasy land, in the real world, you're going to ruin yourself. You're going to destroy the whole thing. And the glorious thing about Jesus is that he's not going to tell you something that's not real and then you find out about it later. And of course, that's what happens. You think you found love, really, this time. And then you find out it was fake. You think you found a job that's really going to make you happy, but you find out the boss didn't even know what he was doing and the whole thing's tanking. Jesus is never going to do that. Jesus is the real stuff in life. And all the other things, matter of fact, we'll say this, right? Or something like this. People will say, something about the Bible. Yeah, this is like an image, but in real life, you know, what's funny is I think actually whatever images God is giving us, that is real life. And whatever's happening around here, if it lines up with whatever Jesus says, then that's real life too. But actually, whatever's going on out here, a lot of it's just fake and it's pretend and it's imitation of the real stuff that God's put together for us. Now, before we move on to what we should do about this glory of Jesus, the significance of Jesus, by the way, isn't that so important to you? Don't you want favor in your life? Financial favor, relational favor, inner mental health and wellness favor, all these things that people are searching for and grasping for, Jesus is that intrinsically. He has that within himself. And of course, we all want to know what's real about whatever matters it may be. And Jesus is the one who is the definition of reality. Remember, he's the Logos upon which all things are built. He's the one that enlightens every man. But before we move on to how we should respond to this and what Jesus expects, I just want to make an observation. Sometimes we can read texts like this, and ones like it. There's one that's very similar that you may be familiar with in the book of Exodus, where God reveals his glory to Moses. And he's bright and shiny, but more so he has characteristics just like this. He's gracious and compassionate, forgiving. He also keeps things real. Whenever people continue in sin, they will be punished. There will be judgment for what's wrong. And Jesus sort of brings that into existence. Maybe before it was an abstract concept that people had to choose whether to accept or not. Jesus embodied those things through his life and especially through his death. But whenever we think about these two elements of Jesus' glory, his grace and his truth, it's easy to think about them, I think, maybe not for you, but I think for me, I can slip into thinking about them as they're these two, this dualistic element of Jesus, and there's this sort of balancing act that Jesus was always going under. And that these two kind of balance each other out, that they work together in that sort of way. The problem with that is that what I'm saying is that grace is somewhat in competition with truth, or truth is in competition with grace. And so what that means is whenever you come to Jesus, you find the parts that you're most drawn to, maybe by your history or personality or whatever. So you like the gracey stuff about Jesus, and when you hit the hard truth, you're like, I don't know about that part. I don't really want to talk about that. It kind of makes me feel icky. And on the other hand, some might say, oh, I really believe in the truth stuff. And we're going to get to reality. But whenever it's time to either pursue reality in pursuit of God's grace or to demonstrate grace, it's like, I don't know, we're being too kind here. You know, we should really be sticking to the truth. I don't think it's appropriate to think in terms of grace and truth as this balancing act of Jesus' dualistic personality. But actually that these two things are blended harmoniously, and that's what really makes Jesus glorious. Because most of us choose one or the other, or we kind of fight in this thing. Jesus was always grace and truth. He's always full of grace and truth. Let me illustrate this with two stories in the Gospel of John. If you want to read them later, you can. I'd encourage you to. John chapter 3, Jesus at night is visited by a man named Nicodemus. Nicodemus was important. He was significant. He was a teacher of Israel, a Pharisee. Apparently an old man by his dialogue with Jesus. He was doing all right for himself. And he came and he said to Jesus, "Teacher, we know that you are from God." He's a nice guy. You know, he's honoring Jesus. "We know that you are from God because no one could do the things that you are doing except God were with him." And Jesus doesn't take the bait of let's all be smart, wise, intelligent people. Jesus instead responds and he says, "Unless someone is born again, cannot enter the kingdom of God." The dialogue continues, and Nicodemus is like, okay, I'll play along, but I mean, how could someone, what are you even talking about? How could someone be born again? How could someone be born? How could someone re-enter his mother's womb whenever he's old? And they go back and forth. Here's my point. The conversation that you read in John chapter 3, Jesus is just kind of up in Nicodemus's grill. I mean, he is getting on him about this stuff and telling him, you can't stay the way you're staying. Because it's not just an abstract thing like, hey, Nicodemus, you should incorporate this into your preaching in synagogue. Actually, what Jesus is saying is, you, my friend, have to start all over. All your religious accomplishments, all the approval you have from people, all the shine that you've gained through all your years, you got to start all over. So let me ask you, in that story, is Jesus grace Jesus or truth Jesus? Which one is he? Obviously truth Jesus, right? I mean, he's hitting this guy hard. He's quoting scripture. He's actually challenging him. At one point, Nicodemus is genuinely confused. And Jesus says, are you the teacher of Israel and you don't understand this stuff? I mean, he's truth Jesus. Come at him hard. And yet, what was the point of the conversation? Unless you're born again, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Which actually means, if you are born again, then you will enter the kingdom of God. Now, let me ask you again. Was this conversation grace Jesus or truth Jesus? And when you read it, it feels kind of hard and it feels very truthy and kind of in your face. And yet it's very clear that the whole point of these truths that Jesus was telling him and the truth that he was unveiling to him was an act of grace. And it was oriented toward receiving grace. Going the other way, John chapter 9. You're going to get how this goes. But in John chapter 9, Jesus happens upon a blind man who'd been blind from birth. He's a grown man. And after some discussion with his apostles, Jesus heals the man. Now, Jesus healed him by making mud, rubbing it on the guy's eyes, and he says, go wash in the pool of Siloam. So the guy goes and does it, and he's healed. And everybody's amazed, except the religious leaders who loved the glory from men rather than the glory from God. So they just rejected Jesus. They wanted other things to be the most significant thing in their life. And so they basically put the guy on trial for getting healed. They were really upset because this healing was done on the Sabbath day, and they thought that was a big no-no. So they bring him in, and they say, hey, what happened? What's going on? And the guy says, well, you know, a man named Jesus rubbed the stuff, told me to do the thing. Now I see. And they say, well, this is bad. What do you think about it? He said, well, he's a prophet. By the way, the reason why that guy knew he was a prophet is Jesus said, go wash, and you'll see. And boom, he did. And of course, also in Jewish history, prophets were the ones who could do this kind of stuff. So he did this thing. He's a prophet. Got to be. They go on and there's some more dialogue and inner room discussion. They bring him back in and they say, hey, we know that this man is a sinner because he's doing healings on the Sabbath. And the guy says, I mean, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. All I know is I was blind. Now I see. They go on with some more discussion and they bring him back in again. And this time the guy, he's figuring some stuff out. I mean, first it was the guy told me to do a thing. I did it. Something happened. That seems like a prophet thing. Don't know if he's a sinner, but I know I can see. But then as it goes on, they bring him in again and they're talking to him. And he says, well, I mean, the more I'm thinking about it, like, God doesn't listen to sinners. God doesn't listen to those who are in rebellion against him. So if this guy, God certainly is listening to this guy because this guy healed me. I mean, if he healed me, then God must be on his side. So I don't see how. Do you guys want to be his disciples? Is that why you're asking me all these questions? And they said, they got all mad at him and they kicked him out. But here's the point. Oh, actually, that's not the end of the story. After that initial act of grace and favor that Jesus bestowed on this man, he gets kicked out of Jewish life because he wasn't lining up with the things that they thought were most significant. And Jesus comes back and finds the man. I love that at the end of John chapter 9. It says that Jesus comes and finds him. When he finds him, he asks him, do you believe in the Son of Man? And the guy doesn't even know who that is. I mean, he did, but he didn't. And he says, well, who is he that I could believe in? And Jesus said, it's the one you've seen. It's the one who's speaking with you. And he said, Lord, I do believe. Now, let me ask you, in that story, is that a Jesus grace story or a Jesus truth story? Well, given the man's sight, that was an act of grace, kindness, beyond imagination. And actually coming back to the man and finding him after he was excluded and kicked out of his family and friends and embracing him, that's an act of grace by Jesus. And yet, what was the result of the grace that Jesus showed this man throughout the story? Actually, because of these two acts of grace at the beginning of John 9 and at the end, this man discovered the truth about Jesus. He thought more about, well, Jesus did this, and that means that, and came to it. And then whenever Jesus says, "Here I am," he says, "Well, yeah, I believe. This is real. You're the real deal." To appreciate the fullness of Jesus, we've got to see how his grace and his truth are inextricably linked together. That they're woven together. They are his glory. Together, they're what make him special. And so we can't separate those things out or pretend like they're in competition with each other or something like that. Because this is what makes Jesus so wonderfully significant, so life-changing. This is what makes him able to rebuild your life, to be something to base your life on. And actually, that's what you're supposed to do about it. So let's finish with this for a few minutes. What am I supposed to do about the glory of Jesus? Are you still there in John chapter 1? If not, go back there. In John chapter 1, in verse 11, we're told what the problem was with a lot of people who interacted with Jesus. Most, I'll say. Maybe even more than we'd like to think in this very room. And I hope that's not true. But verse 11 says, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. They did not receive him. In other words, Jesus came to reveal his glory. This is what makes me great. I'm the most significant thing. I'm the best. I'm the thing. And a lot of people looked at it and they said, no thanks. Matter of fact, there's a story about that in John chapter 6. I do want to read a few verses here just for exhortative purposes. Have you reflected earlier about the things that you tend to find most significant, that you orient your whole life around, that dominate your thoughts and your dreams and your hopes and all that stuff? Have you thought about that pretty clearly so you know what your thing is? In John chapter 6, there were a group of people that had a number of things that they found to be more significant than the reality, the favorable reality about Jesus. And in John chapter 6, Jesus was preaching to them. We won't go into the whole context just for sake of time. But Jesus speaks in terms of them needing to receive him. I'll just make this point. In the Gospel of John, Jesus often spoke of himself in terms of this idea of needing to receive him. He would say to a woman one time who was confused both about what would be gracious and what was true. And he said, "Listen, if you listen to me, I'll actually tell you about water that will spring up inside you like a wellspring. I'll fill you up. You won't be thirsty anymore. Not for religious knowledge, just abstract religious knowledge. You won't be thirsty for men anymore. I'll quench your thirst if you'll come to me. But you got to receive me." Later on in the Gospel of John, Jesus would talk about himself as the light of the world. And of course, right now, everybody's so happy. It's fall. Everybody's got their PSLs, having a good time out here. But you know, in a few months, everybody's like, "Oh, where's the sun?" And then it's going to start coming out. And one day, you're going to walk out, probably not this dramatically, but you're going to walk out one day, and you're just going to stand there, and you're just going to receive the sun. And it's going to change something about you, about your persona, about the way you think, about the way you carry on your day, because you're receiving something. Jesus says, "I am the light that you have to receive." And yet, so often, people will not. The image here in John chapter 6, it was actually read at the table this morning, is that Jesus is the bread of life. Look at verse 48 of John 6. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness," the thing that sustained them, the thing that was most significant in their life. They're supposed to every morning go out and get the manna, get the food that they were going to need to eat to sustain their day. "Your fathers ate that." They had another significant thing that kept them going. "This is the bread that comes down out of heaven," verse 50. Oh, by the way, verse 49 says, they died. That stuff didn't work for them. But verse 50, "This is the bread which comes down out of heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. And if anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread also which I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." The people argued about this and were, I'm not sure if they were confused by it or if they just said, "No, we're not interested in that level of commitment." Every time I read this chapter, I think differently about what it is. I know it certainly would have been confusing. And I believe based on their actions, it indicates that it was more than just confusing them. As a matter of fact, maybe some of them understood precisely what Jesus was saying. That he wasn't just using a weird metaphor to weird people out. But he was actually trying to say, "Listen, I've got to be the food that keeps you going every day. And you can't come to me and just sort of do it halfway. You can't come to me and just have me for a snack every once in a while when you feel like it. I've got to be the thing that gives you survival and life. Because of this, many people left. Matter of fact, the text says that all departed him, except the 12. And Jesus turns to them in verse 60. So let's read verse 66 of John 6. As a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So Jesus said to the 12, "You do not want to go away also, do you?" And I wonder, was it a quick answer? Was it a long pause? One of those awkward moments where everybody isn't really sure what to say? I don't know. But Simon Peter, speaking for himself, and I think for the whole group, he said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Peter says, "We've done the math." But I think it indicates they thought about it. Could we leave? Should we leave? And the conclusion was, how could we? This is the one. This is the one. Every favor we could seek in going fishing or collecting taxes or leading political rebellions or whatever it may be in our day-to-day lives, whatever truth we could find from any other teacher or any other experiences or any other inner reflections, it's going to mean nothing. To whom shall we go? Do you agree with Peter? Now, I know, sitting in this pew and singing these songs and feeling very whatever we feel right now, the answer is, oh, yeah, I agree. Are you going to agree tomorrow with that statement? That Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, the God-man who dwelt among us, full of grace and full of truth, is he glorious in your eyes? Is he glory? Maybe I'll say it that way, because there's lots of things that are glorious. But is he the glory? Is he the thing that your life is completely formed around? Because that's what Jesus says you got to do. You got to receive me. Do you notice back in the text, I really like this, in John chapter 1, it says in verse 16, "For of his," not glory this time, but he used another word that helps us understand just how significant Jesus' significance really is. "For of his fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace." Now certainly that means we get the whole thing of Jesus. It's not like Jesus gives part of himself, but it's his grace and truth. It's all his glory. It's all of himself. He laid it all on the line for us. But if we're receiving his fullness, then doesn't that mean that our lives are going to have to be full of him? And when you're full, that means there's no more space for anything else. Now, don't get me wrong. This doesn't mean you don't have a career, you don't love people, or you're not involved in community service, or you don't go have fun with whatever you do to have fun with your friends on the weekend. But what it does mean is all of those things are totally reformatted. They don't mean what they used to anymore. And they have to mean something quite different. Because now all of those things, you only experience them or do them through the lens of what it means to be receiving Jesus, to be full of Jesus, to understand God through him and to have him dominate your life and to fill you up just like bread and to drink him in like water and to be shone upon by him just like light from the sun. That's what Jesus means, and nothing less and nothing else. And if you're trying to make Jesus something less or something else, then you're not getting him at all, honestly. You're just not getting him at all. And just like those people, they got it. Whether they understood the whole thing or not, I don't know. But they at least understood this. It's all of Jesus or we're out of here. And I'll just tell you that one of the most dangerous things we could ever do is for me to convince myself that, oh, yeah, I've received Jesus, when all I'm trying to do is snack on him once in a while. That I'm not being filled with him. That my life is not being dominated by him. That I'm letting other things take priority over him in my schedule or in my emotions or in the way I use my money or in the way I treat people or whatever it may be. The only way this thing works is if you understand that he is the priority, that he is the significant thing, that he is the glory of your life. Now you say, okay, that sounds just hard. And it is actually sometimes. But all the important things are hard, aren't they? in your life. And the reason why you do the hard things that are important, reformatting your life's priorities to do all sorts of things, giving up sleep, giving up money, giving up time, giving your all that kind of stuff. The reason why you're willing to do that is you think there's some sort of payoff. So what is the payoff? Look at John 1 and verse 12, and we'll finish here. John 1 and verse 12. You know, the text says further down of his fullness, as we just read, we have all received. Okay, so does this mean I just become a gracious person? Does that mean become a real person? Well, yeah, actually. You receive favor from God. Just as Jesus was full of grace, you receive that. Just as Jesus is filled with truth and what's real and what's right, you become full of that. Verse 12 actually gives us a little bit, maybe a more helpful image to help us understand what it means to receive the fullness of Jesus. Verse 12, as many as did receive him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. So in other words, the glory that Jesus revealed, and by the way, did you notice the way that John describes it in verse 14 and verse 18? The glory that Jesus revealed is the glory of the only begotten, or the Son of God. And what he showed is, hey, this is what it means to be in closest fellowship with the Father. This is what it means to belong to God and to be close to him and to have his favor in your life and to have your life shaped by the reality that he's set down from before time even began. This is what it means to be a son of God. And that's not just something we say, oh, wow, that's very interesting, Jesus. Thank you for showing me that. I'm going to do whatever you tell me now. All that's true. But the reason why is because we too become sons of God through Jesus Christ. And I don't know if I get how important that is every day. But I know there's nothing more significant that you could ever have in your Instagram profile or on your LinkedIn account or in your resume or when you introduce yourself or whenever people know you or whatever they put on your tombstone. Nothing else could be more significant than to say, here lies a son of God. And if you question that, just think a little bit. Imagine that you don't have a family. Maybe that's not an imagination for you. Maybe it's a hardship you've had to deal with. Or maybe your family's complicated or broken in some sort of a horrific way. And imagine that you had, therefore, no real sense of worth and identity because you hadn't received love and all that kind of support. Not only that, it was hard for you to figure out how to do things. You just weren't very wise because nobody ever taught you how to live life on a day-to-day basis. Beyond all that, you didn't know where your life was going, what your future would hold. And then someone came along, and he was rich and powerful. But not the dirty, bad sort of rich and powerful that maybe so often gets associated with those kinds of words. He was kind, benevolent, compassionate. But he wasn't the silly kind of rich and powerful, kind, benevolent, compassionate kind of person. He was wise and fair. And he always did the best thing. And that person sat you down and he said, hey, I've heard what you've gone through. And if you'll receive what I'd like to offer you, which is myself, then I'd like you to become my child. I'd like you to come into my home. I'd like to teach you not just how you could behave better, but actually how you could become just like me, so that one day you too will be rich and powerful, and but kind and benevolent and compassionate and wise and fair and just in all your dealings. I'd like to show you what the world is really all about, because I've obviously figured it out. Not being arrogant, just the truth. And if you come and you listen to me and you do what I tell you and you trust in me and you come to me when you're in trouble and you share what's on your heart and what's wrong, and then I'll tell you stuff to help you go and fix it, and then you just stay close to me forever and ever, then you'll be okay. That's the offer of the gospel. Is that the glory that Jesus possesses from God could be glory that he would share with us. You see, to receive him is to receive the whole deal, the burden and the blessing. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9 says it this way. Speaking about Jesus, he used the same kind of language that John did, where he said, we see him, we beheld him, who was made for a little while lower than the angels. He became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus, who because of the suffering of death was crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. And the punchline is that if you will receive him, just as he has promised to receive you, even you, in all your sin, if you will receive him, then the text continues to tell us what that means. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to share in the very glory that Jesus himself possesses, that if we come to him, he will bring us to share in that glory before God and even now, that God would perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and they who sanctified are all from one, for which reason he is not ashamed. Jesus, the glorious one, the glory. He's not ashamed to call you and me his brethren, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will sing your praise. I don't know where you're at this morning. Maybe you need some help figuring out if you really believe in all this glory of Jesus stuff. We can help you with that. Grab anybody here, and if they're just like you, y'all both go together and find somebody else till you find somebody that can sit you down and try to help you understand this stuff that we've only introduced this morning. Maybe you're here and you're convicted and you know that Jesus is not the most significant thing, and at the end of your life, your tombstone might as well be blank the way you're living right now, because your life will mean nothing at the end. That can change. You can turn away from this world and turn away from yourself and turn away from your sin. And if you will believe in the Son, if you'll believe in the glory of the Son, full of grace and full of truth and all the great things, if you'll give your life to him, if you will receive him, confessing his name, being baptized into him, so he'll take away your sins and you'll be raised up, clothed with Christ as the Son of God, everything can start new. And if you're here and you've been a son of God, but you're just giving up the glorious life and position, you've been living like a son of the world, do not walk out of this room without doing something about it. Wherever you are, you may need to come forward and ask for prayers and help from everyone. You may need to grab someone, grab one of the shepherds, grab a Christian here who can help you. You can come talk to me, but there's so many people here. Whatever you need to do, don't walk out of this room without making Jesus the glory of your life. Let's stand and sing.